Today's episode is brought to you by Lisa Frankenstein, a new horror rom-com starring Catherine Newton as misunderstood teenager Lisa Swallows and Cole Sprouse as handsome reanimated corpse, The Creature. From acclaimed Jennifer's Body writer Diablo Cody, Lisa Frankenstein is only in theatres February 9th.
Director Zelda Williams teams up with my girl, Oscar-winning screenwriter Diablo Cody for a new 80s-inspired coming-of-rage love story and an instant addition to my personal weird girl canon. Together, Lisa and the creature embark on a murderous journey to find love, happiness, and a few missing body parts along the way.
This Valentine's Day, dig up someone special. Lisa Frankenstein is only in theatres February 9. Visit lisafrankensteinfilm.com to get tickets now.
This week on Best in Show, it's an international film feast with the culinary artisans of The Taste of Things, Juliette Binoche, and Tran Anh Hung. The table is set. Clean plates only, people. Hello, and welcome to Best in Show, a limited podcast series brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. I am Mia Lee Vicino, the West Coast editor here at Letterboxd, and Best in Show is all about awards season. We meet contenders from this year's movies, interrogate insiders about the film ecosystem, and we look into Letterboxd data on the noms and gongs. Mostly, we do what we always do here at Letterboxd, celebrate cinema. And joining me in my dining room are my Best in Show besties, Hollywood veteran and our editorial producer, Brian Formo.
Bonjour.
And our editor-in-chief, Gemma Gracewood.
Bon appetit.
Bonjour, bonjour. Oh, inspired by The Taste of Things, this episode is structured like a gourmet European meal with multiple courses. We will nibble a little bit on the five films that were nominated for Best International Feature at the Oscars and two French films that weren't. We dig into the drama behind the scenes there, along with a little preview of France's own Oscars, the César Awards, which are handed out later this month.
Naturally, we start at the beginning with hors d'oeuvre, a little taste of what's in our awards season Letterboxd Diaries. And I think this week we all made a point to watch one of the Oscar nominees for Best International Feature. So, Mia, where in the world did you go?
Oh, Cece, Gemma. I'll start in my beautiful home country of Italy. Andiamo, andiamo. Ho guardato il capitano. Okay, I'm going to switch to English now because I have exhausted all the Italian I have retained from my 2 years of classes in college.
Bene, bene.
I watched Io Capitano, which was Italy's submission for Best International Film at the Oscars this year. It did secure that nomination as well as a whopping 12 awards at Venice Film Festival, including Best Director for Matteo Garrone and Best Young Actor for Seydou Sarr. So Seydou leads as a Senegalese teenager who, along with his friend, plan to travel from their hometown of Dakar through Mali, the Nigerian desert, and Libya, then all the way across the Mediterranean Sea to Italy, in the hopes that they will escape poverty and fulfill their dreams of becoming musicians. But it is never that easy. This is inspired by true stories of African migrants' perilous journeys to Europe. Though the way that it approaches the narrative involves these little bouts of surrealism, which make the Odyssey seem kind of mythical despite its roots in reality. So magical realism, that's fun. Medical racism is not so, and Io Capitano explores this and other very, very worthy and under-talked about global issues, but its main attraction is it has this really beautiful humanistic perspective on migration, which Letterboxd member Max the Wicked actually praises in their review. So here it is, translated from Italian. Matteo Garrone has done more with this film for the cause of migrants than the European Union or any of our interior ministers. This film, straight to every school. Thank you. Several Italian language reviews actually asked to send this film to a minister, and I, as an American, learned what that is. So thank you, Io Capitano. Brian, teach us something. I just learned what a minister is. Do you have anything to teach me next?
Well, I went to Germany and I only know one German word, and that's Ausfahrt, which means exit, even though it looks like it's something much worse.
Wait, that's the only German word you know? Germany has such brilliant words. Schadenfreude.
I guess I know the ones that we use. I mean, Uber. But Mia was setting me up perfectly, and I instead I brought up Osfart, but I did watch The Teacher's Lounge, which is Germany's submission. It is a, you know, there's a lot of European films are doing this thing where they're tracking the mood of the continent, like how everyone is displeased with their government and placing it into a small community drama. Here, this is like the perfect chosen community. This movie is great. It's a middle school in Germany. And it's a sixth grade teacher. My wife, who used to teach sixth grade, told me that it was a perfect depiction because they enter as little angels, but through hormones and being unable to process unjust things, they have the potential to become monsters by the end of the year. So it's adults and kids, the teachers and the students. The adults are worried about a petty theft that is happening, which I think is a brilliant stroke because it's very small stakes. One of my favorite things in it is the media is represented by the school newspaper, which is run mostly by eighth graders who like tower over the sixth graders and boss them around and they think they know everything. But they also make everything more black and white, the older kids. It's like us versus them. And so this small grievance that happens becomes this massive problem for the kids and the parents who are in charge of them. I'm purposely not saying what the various grievances are because, you know, that's part of the experience of watching it. And you can watch it next week. It releases in the US February 16th. Director Ilker Shutak is Turkish. He was raised in Germany, and I caught up with him in Palm Springs. And he told me how excited he was to get a text from one of Germany's greats, Wim Wenders. And he also talked about his use of government infrastructure in Germany to make films, a theme that we're going to be talking about throughout this episode. Let's hear what he has to say here.
And, you know, the cool thing is, like, we're now shortlisted, and Wim Wenders is there as well. And the other day he texted me, and it's, like, so surreal because I was a little kid watching his films. And Wim Wenders was just like the guy, you know. It's just incredible. It's like this fairy tale being here and being amongst all these brilliant minds. So yeah, it's a great honor.
I love that, but I would also love a text from Wim Wenders congratulating me for watching Perfect Days this week. I finally got around to it. It's in New Zealand cinemas right now. And if you'll permit me a small digression as I talk about Perfect Days, we've just dropped a Four Faves on our Letterboxd socials from Paul Young, the CEO of my favourite animation house, Cartoon Saloon. He's award season relevant. He is up for Best Director at the Annie Animation Awards for his episode of Star Wars Visions. And anyway, in his Four Faves, Paulie basically says, I'm in a beautiful Irish accent, so international feature relevant too. I'm a sucker for films that have a great soundtrack. Well, I am also a sucker for films that have a great soundtrack. And Perfect Days has a great soundtrack. Patti Smith, Lou Reed, The Kinks, Otis Redding, Nina Simone. At one point, the lead in the film visits a record shop that I myself have visited in Shimokitazawa in Tokyo. So, you know, basically, I felt so seen. And more than that, Mia, Brian, have I ever told you about all the jobs I've had that have involved cleaning toilets?
No.
Gemma, spill.
So many jobs involving cleaning toilets, including at my parents' own catering company, cleaned many a toilet after a drunken wedding. You know, yeah. I feel this main character's pain. I also once had a job, Mia, as an Italian, probably of somewhat Catholic origin, you'll appreciate this, cleaning the priest's toilets at the local cathedral.
I didn't think priests used the bathroom.
Well, it turns out they do.
Wow.
If only because it also turns out they drink a lot of whiskey and port in a week because I noticed the turnover in the liquor cabinet at that place. Oh. Anyway, moving on.
First Reformed mention there.
Exactly. <Yeah. laughs> This is quite the digression. There was also the job I had at a cafe where I got bullied and ultimately fired because I made the other staff look bad by how clean I kept those toilets.
Punished for being exceptional.
I know. So long story short, I am a sucker for films that have a great soundtrack and are about people who clean toilets. So, you know, colour me the perfect audience for Perfect Days. And there is no way in the world that a movie marketing agency could figure that out from my demographics, I bet. I was looking at Letterboxd reviews, and Mackie Berg writes, well, actually, first of all, they had an immersive experience. I've had the same experience in the same cinema, or a similar experience. The train and construction sounds in the Angelica cinema always seem to match the film I'm watching, and indeed matched Perfect Days. I love that. But more than that, Mackie Berg writes something that I thought a lot while I was watching. Such a calm film, something my dad would love. Mm. And given that my dad was responsible for teaching me how to clean a toilet, I really felt his absence while I was watching this, but also his presence, I guess. What else can I say about Perfect Days? I also love Wim Wenders and Tokyo and playing tic-tac-toe. Therefore, it is a perfect film. But having said that, is it perfect enough to be one of the 5 international feature nominees? On the Wim Wenders scale and the Letterboxd data, it sits behind Paris, Texas and Wings of Desire in his highest rated film. So it's, you know, it's not his greatest. And honestly, I'm going to be honest here. I do think that there were far more exquisitely constructed films on this year's long list. Iraq's submission, Hanging Gardens, which takes Lars and the Real Girl into quite incredible territory. Macedonia's Housekeeping for Beginners, just the most beautiful LGBT story about found family. And most especially Nigeria's Mummy Water, which should have been nominated for Hair and Makeup alone, but definitely for international feature. But I mean, it's the Oscars, right? It's all about a campaign and it's about familiarity. So I think we all know what the Oscar voters were really here for, because we're here for him too. Almost every Letterboxd reviewer has something to say about leading man Koji Yakusho, and so does his director, Wim Wenders.
I've been there countless times in Japan, felt homesick if I wasn't there for a while. And when I received the invitation to do this film in 2022, I was really happy. The fact that Perfect Days is now nominated as Japanese entry to the Oscars was a little bit of a shock for me when I got the call from Tokyo. Guess what? I realized it was a great responsibility, but then I also realized that Japanese love this man very much. They love the Koji Yakusho, and he's a great hero there. And so I figured Perfect Days was the Japanese entry because of him. And I'm just the director's sidekick.
I also really liked Denmark's The Promised Land that was on the short list that didn't make it. There were a lot of great potential nominees here. So like, and a lot of
Fallen
them are
Fallen Leaves.
Yeah, Fallen Leaves, and a lot of them are coming out in the coming weeks. So even if they weren't nominated, look up the short list and watch those movies anyway.
Yeah, we can still love these movies anyway. But honestly, that final continuous shot in Perfect Days of Koji is, I mean, that one shot is Oscar worthy alone for just the pure joy it brings. And I was thinking actually, Mia, that Perfect Days, the soundtrack, actually would be a great dinner party playlist for this episode.
Okay, that's perfect, because while we're talking about music and music legends, let's do a quick little sidestep into the Grammys to note that Brett Morgan's Moon Age Daydream won Best Music Film. So well deserved. Woohoo!
Good on you, Brett. You know, I interviewed Brett for Journal. You can read that interview. I asked him, what did it take to make this film? And he said, 7 years and a heart attack and not enough time with my children. So I'm really glad he's getting his trophies. What else got trophies at the Grammys?
Barbie also got a lot of trophies. They swept the rest of the screen wins at the Grammys. They won Best Original Song, What Was I Made For? That's 3 wins for Billy and Phineas, the Golden Globes, Grammys, and Hollywood Music and Media. What Was I Made For also won Song of the Year, and Barbie also won Best Soundtrack.
Okay, y'all. We're ready for the next course. Well, I am at least. Are you guys?
My tummy is rumbling.
Let's move on to the appetizers. Okay, we've got mailbag questions, Gemma. Please serve us up a letter to take us behind the curtain of the international feature category.
I have always wanted to serve a letter on a silver platter like they do in the movies. So here it is. Hang on. This is from Kelly. Hi, Kelly. One of my favorite aspects of film is how it can transport me to other places in the world. I love seeing other cultures and hearing other languages, but what's the criteria to qualify for the Best International Feature Oscar? This year, there's The Zone of Interest, which was filmed in Germany and features German actors speaking in German, but it's categorized as from the UK. Similarly, with The Society of the Snow, it's in the Spanish language and it features primarily Uruguayan and Argentinian actors and locations, but it's up for Spain. Is it just about where the money came from? Thanks. Thanks, Kelly. Brian, something tells me you have the recipe for this dish.
Yes, it's if you want to eat money, that is how they determine these. That's largely how it's determined, is where the money comes from. And outside of Hollywood and the US generally, most funding for films from most other countries, or at least a portion of the finance, comes from their country's public arts funds and rebate programs via government agencies like film commissions. So for Zone of Interest, with Jonathan Glazer being British and using a largely British crew, he utilized the UK infrastructure to make the film, even though it was not filmed in his home country and it is in a different language. For a bigger budget film like The Society of the Snow, there are public and private funds involved. That film is Spain's Oscar entry, as Kelly mentioned, even though it is an Uruguayan story. We actually had London editor Ella Kemp, that a lot of Best in Show listeners have become familiar with her voice here. She asked Society of the Snow's director, J.A. Bayana, to explain the whole international feature process a little more. Have a listen.
I'm really interested in hearing about how it is decided, which country is able to put it forward, because, you know, it's huge for Uruguay. You've got Argentinian actors. It is in Spanish. What are the kind of decisions in, which country it's representing?
Yeah, well, there is like a bureaucracy. This is a Spanish film. It's co-produced with Netflix. So it has the Spanish nationality. So it's representing Spain, and most of the crew is Spanish and the director is I'm Spanish. So it's a lot of Spanish talent, and the fund comes from Spain. So that gives you the nationality, and then you can get the option of representing your country. Actually, the nomination goes to the country. So the Oscar for Best International is Spain who wins the Oscar, and the director accepts the award in the name of the country. So you don't get the nomination.
So it wouldn't be yours,
it would be Spain.
How does that make you feel?
I'm okay. I'm good. I'm great. But it's kind of fun that it's the country who wins the Oscar, and the director accepts the award in the name of the country. You know, so it's Spain. But one of the things that I'm most proud of is that it's a Spanish film with Uruguayan actors and Argentinian actors that has been shot in Spain, Uruguay, Argentina, and Chile. So it's, to me, it's been so hard to get the finance to do this film. Actually, it's an impossible film. Right now, there's not enough market to finance a film in Spanish that goes over a budget of 10 million. With a 10 million budget, it's impossible to shoot a movie like this one in real locations for such a long time. So it was impossible to finance this film, which is sad, because at the end, we are always shooting the same movies in the same languages, you know. To me, I wanted to raise this flag of calling the attention of the audience and tell them you can enjoy movies like these ones in big theaters also, not only in small art houses that are great, but are not enough to finance a big budget movie. So for me, it's great to represent this whole Spanish speaking community, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, and Spain, fighting to compete with the other films in our own language, telling our story in our language. And it would be great if actually the film is doing really, really well. It's working really well. Not only on Netflix, that it's gigantic, but also in theaters in Argentina or Spain and Uruguay has done very well. So it's like a way of breaking this kind of glass ceiling that we have for when we talk about shooting films in our language.
J.A. and Brian both brought up government money and government submissions for the international feature, so we gotta get into this whole Anatomy of a Fall versus the Taste of Things submission drama in France. I have been having conversations with friends, accidental Sally Rooney reference, about confusion around this perceived, quote, snub of Anatomy of a Fall from the international film category. Here is a short and sweet mailbag question from Jossie. Thank you, Gemma. Who is in charge of submitting films for international Oscars?
The simple answer is that each country's government can only submit one film to represent their country at the Academy Awards each year.
Which had me imagining that there are, you know, prime ministers and presidents around the world just kind of, I don't know, sitting in their office with all of the films playing in the background while they do their bigger international business and then kind of going that one. But that's not how it works. Of course, the more complex answer is that governments appoint, generally a committee is appointed by a government's film body, so a film commission or agency. That committee is then responsible for the selection procedures. And the members of that committee change from either year to year or, you know, certain committee periods. So then the members of the committee, will consult representatives from many corners of their film industry, and the names of those committee members are generally published for transparency. So we know that in France, for this year's selection, Oscar-winning CODA producer Patrick Washberger was on the committee. So he knows a thing or two about awards season. So, you know, that seems like they're definitely making moves to put people in who understand what it takes to be in the awards conversation and make it all the way through, whether that worked for them or not. More on that soon. Filmmaker Olivier Assayas was also on the French committee, and composer Alexandre Desplat. I hope, Alexandre, I said your name correctly. So this committee calls for film submissions from their country's filmmakers. They host screenings of the films and then they vote. And voting might be secret or it might be open, but generally you can't abstain. You have to choose one film. So then eventually they land on a choice.
And what a choice it was this year. France submitted The Taste of Things, which is a wonderful, wonderful film deserving of praise. And it won Best Director for Tran on Hung at Cannes. But Anatomy of a Fall won the Palme d'Or. So, Jossie, I can see that it is confusing to work out how Oscar International Feature Films get submitted, especially when Anatomy of a Fall is nominated in five Oscar categories, none of which is international feature.
There's been, there's been a whirlwind of speculation in regards to this decision, and it does feel particularly raw, knowing that only a few years ago, France did the same dirty to Céline Sciamma and Portrait of a Lady on Fire, choosing Les Misérables instead. Also a good film, but come on, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. So it sort of seems like there's a lot of people involved in the selection. It does get both political and personal. On the personal side, Olivier Assayas, he's a Juliette Binoche girly. He's worked with her a bunch of times and he's on the selection committee. And it's also political. There's word on the street that the French government weren't happy with Justine Triet's Palme d'Or acceptance speech for Anatomy at Cannes, in which she rightfully criticised French President Emmanuel Macron's repression of pension reform protests. And you might remember that Céline and her film star Adèle Haenel also didn't hold back in their activism during Portrait's award season run.
And during Justine's speech, she also said that the commodification of culture that the neoliberal government defends is in the process of breaking the French cultural exception. And Cannes Mayor David Lisnard responded by tweeting that she was a, quote, spoiled child. I personally prefer to think of her as an intelligent, badass adult woman instead, but to each their own, I suppose. So in the end, Anatomy has nominations for Best Picture, Director, Original Screenplay, Actress, and Editing, while unfortunately, The Taste of Things failed to secure a nomination in the International Feature category. Again, they're both brilliant, brilliant films, and we hate to pit two beautiful queens against each other.
It got a little murkier. I was thinking all along, you know, oh, well, surely Taste of Things will over-index at the César Awards, at their own Oscars. But when you left Hollywood and you went to France, both Anatomy and Taste are up for awards, but it's Anatomy that has 11 nominations, 12 if you include the high school award.
The high school award? Oh, this is where high school students get to vote on the best picture finalists.
Yeah.
That's my favorite César award.
Yeah, so it's best film. It's up for best film twice from the French Academy and also for the high school students. That Anatomy of a Fall, that is. The Taste of Things did receive 3 César nominations for gorgeous, gorgeous craft, cinematography, production design, and costume design. I expected to see it more. I mean, it, like you said, it won Best Director at Cannes, which is almost like runner-up. It should have played. You would think they would place more. Juliette Binoche is amazing in this film, but it feels like there was maybe a little bit of a reprimand from the French Academy to the Film Commission here too.
Right. So one selection committee and another selection committee having a go at each other through their choices. That's really interesting. I tell you what's not murky in all of this. The Letterboxd data. We always promise that we will dig into the Letterboxd data around the noms and gongs. And so here it is. And bearing in mind that Anatomy of a Fall has had a wider theatrical release than The Taste of Things, which is only just opening in US cinemas. But on average, The Taste of Things has a 3.8 out of 5, which is great. I mean, that is, you know, that's a Letterboxd 5-star, as we all know. But Anatomy of a Fall, sitting high with a 4.2 average, 161,000 people have punched that heart button. And so far, over 3,000 Letterboxd members have put Anatomy of a Fall in their 4 favourites. So you know, both films landing really well with our community, but neither are up for international feature. And surprising fact, France hasn't won the Oscar for international feature since 1993 for Indochine, and they've only received 2 nominations in the past decade.
I'm pouring one out for Palme d'Or winner Titon.
You should have won. You were a nominee.
We could have had it all. Nevertheless, the Césars will be handed out February 23rd. But since we've been so focused on Anatomy of a Fall versus Taste of Things, we wanted to serve up a little treat from both films. However, my amuse-bouche interview with Anatomy star Snoop the Dog is not up until next week, which I'm sure I will earn a Pulitzer for. It's hard-hitting journalism. So
A Peabody and a Pulitzer.
Come on. So for today's main course, Brian, you spoke to the star of The Taste of Things, Juliette Binoche, and her director, Tran Anh Hung, and you've been waiting weeks to serve this up.
It's true. The movie is finally in U.S. cinemas now. February 9th, today. It expands on Valentine's Day. It is a love story of sorts. It slowly reveals the aroma of love wafts its way up. One of the beautiful things about The Taste of Things is how it closes the loop of an off-screen relationship. So if you don't know going in, Juliette Binoche and her co-star Benoît Magimel were once married and they have a daughter together. They've been estranged, but this film brought them back together, and it's actually quite lovely, and I really appreciate what Juliette has to say about that in our interview as well. Before we get into film specifics, I'm going to reach into our Letterboxd crew mailbag with a question from Mitchell Beaupre, who also saw and loved the film. They say, I'm most interested in hearing your thoughts on the comforting, nurturing aspect of food, how the love and care you put into crafting a meal is an extension of the love and care that you have for the person that you're creating it for.
I suppose I have to start, Hung, because you said you don't cook, right? So I do cook. Sometimes I cook exasperated because I have other things to do and I want to get over it. And some other times I cook because I've invited people to come in, family or friends, and then it needs to be something special because I invited them. Sometimes I take the whole day, and sometimes I asked some people working at my house, that they can help me peeling, you know, doing half the work because I don't always have the time. But at the end of the day, I love it because it's a time that is different from acting, which can be, you know, emotionally so demanding. So it can have a sort of relaxing, you know, time and also the excitement of trying to put things together, you know, what start are you going to do? And, you know, all that, because it's sort of an architecture of, you know, how you're going to put it together.
Hung, if you're not a major into cooking, then I would, what I would rephrase to you, as a filmmaker, you know, the reward comes kind of at the end, like the applause at the end. It's about the entire experience, but so much about food is the first bite and the really initial reaction and how, I guess, how different is that creatively and conveying that on the screen as well?
Well, I mean, even if I don't cook, I help in the kitchen. I help my wife. So when we invite, you know, friends, we spend a day to cook. Before that, I would go to the market and buy everything. So I wash, I cut, and she cook. And I see how much the nature of cooking is a caring. You know, it's something that is really obvious. It's nature. It's a generosity and sharing. So everything need to be carefully done. You have to present everything in a certain way. It cannot be another way. And so my wife, she's there and she told me how to do it, you know, how to present everything because it need to be also very appealing for the eyes. And that was, you know, the nature of cooking.
And because the film starts with the process of revealing the characters through the process of cooking, I'd like to kind of start there. With how you film the cooking scenes, the environment of the movement in that kitchen and the beauty of everything being prepared, and for Juliet, how you approach building a character kind of wordlessly through the start, through movement and spatial interactions in the kitchen.
Yes, these scenes were really difficult to shoot because you need to be at the same time very free and also very precise. And we need to see everything. We need to see what is cooking and the faces and the hands and all the body, how the body is engaged in this process, because it need to be at the same time very harmonious and at the same time very sensual. So all this has need to bring this quality of harmony to the audience, and that was really difficult. And of course, I rely on Juliet, on Benoit for that, because it's everything we see on the screen. It's them making these dishes, so. I absolutely trust, you know, how they will take care of it.
Hung had to remind me all the time, please smile, please smile, be happy, because yeah. I tend, you know, to be a little too serious when I'm doing things. So it was good to start like that, you know. He reminded me that this character is. You know, she's going to love until the end. She's going to love doing everything she can, you know, until the end.
Mm-hmm. I'd seen you mention that you weren't, you felt free in adapting the text that this is based on, largely because you didn't really love the book itself. So can you speak to how that was freeing, but then also maybe how that opened up for you, Juliet, to kind of collaborate to create a character? Because the text itself starts from my understanding, where the film ends. So you had all the space to create.
I think what I liked was this idea that I have my age and somehow I understand differently life. I enjoy more nature, small things, and being really grateful, you know, to the pleasure that I have being alive. you know, meeting a surrounding by people that I love. So I wanted to make a movie to show my gratitude about this, you know, about all this. And the age of the character was so beautiful for me. And Juliette at her age, she's absolutely, you know, marvelous. So for me, it was so perfect to have Juliette and Benoît to tell this this story of, you know, this the autumn in our life. It's so rare in cinema. So that was my idea.
I remember when I first read the first script that Hoon gave me, Eugénie didn't have that much of space in a way. So I said that to Hoon, and I said, of course, I want to work with you because I love your films. And there's a sensitivity in Hoon's way of also of listening or of speaking. You know, he's very precise, but it's very subtle at the same time. So I'm very touched by that. And when I read the script, I said, I'd love to work with you, but please try to develop this character a little more. So I feel like more being in, you know, involved in the film. And so he did. And he didn't take very much time, maybe a month or so. And he came back with that script that we shot. And I was just, you know, really, really happy because I've never played a role like this, you know, with that. Is living with her own ways, you know, her own limits, saying yes to something and no to another. You know, it's a long-lasting relationship, and usually I'm working in films where, yeah, you know, it screams or it's very conflictual, and in this one, they're reserved in, you know, they're things that she has her limits, and I love that. That there was a harmony, even though you're different. And I'd like to achieve that in my life, but I haven't done that yet. So I think this film is a good hint of inspiration for that, you know, for that need, because who doesn't want to be harmonious unless you're twisted totally inside of you? But of course, we want to have that trust between two people and care and you know, acknowledging the differences without being bothered by them, to tolerate differences, and that's maturity. Or maybe unless you're born like this, you know, there might be some people at 20 years old they already know that. I'm still working on it because it's a long journey to have that, to allow this to happen.
Mm-hmm. And you bring up the intensity usually from your roles. I mean, the role of dinner in movies is very different here as well, because dinner scenes in films are often the setting for an eventual argument. Here, it's the discussion of the food and its extension of it. So how French is it to spend dinner talking about the food, and which course do the arguments generally start in?
Absolutely. That's the probably the main subject in French conversations is about food. and sometimes I find it a little boring, I have to say, because you want to lift it somewhere. I mean, it's lovely. Of course, you want to know, how did you make this? You know, of course, you want to know the recipe. You want to know the secrets, you know, because it's yummy. It's like, you know, any arts, you want to know what's behind it. But there's a moment you want to lift it to somewhere else. What do you think, Hoon?
Yes, I think that for me it's quite special because as a Vietnamese, I came to France when I was 12, so I discovered France and this conversation, you know, around the table. It's something that for me was really, really beautiful and very French. You know, and they talk about everything. About food, but also about culture. When it's a family and you have the kids, you know, they have their time, you know, they have their moment during the dinner or the lunch. to tell about, you know, what they have read. They saw something or they listened to a music, and they have to talk about it. And it's very, at the same time, very scary for me as a stranger to come. And I was afraid that, you know, people ask me, so lately, what book did you like, etc. So and I have to say, you know, how I like it, etc. So it's quite scary for me. But I found it so beautiful that, you know, people talk to each other around the table.
I think Hung is one of the people who embraced France the most that I've known, because mm-hmm. the French culture, French like disliking themselves, and they poo-poo a little bit of the Frenchy stuff. But Hung is, you know, is fascinated by it. He's loving it, and it's true in the film. You see it. You see the feelings, the French kind of way of expressing feelings. So the literature, the way you wrote the script, is very French. It's mm-hmm. the most French that I've seen. Yeah. And it's very moving for me, being born in France and seeing, you know, you as a foreigner who in Britain now you're half French, let's say, or you know, you're very much embrace that culture. But it's very moving for me to see how much you worshiping this qualities, you know, this specific qualities.
Yes, especially moved by the scene with the long table. And how Dodin talk about autumn, all this for me sounds very, very, very French. And I was very happy to be able to write this scene like that. It was very difficult for me.
Juliet, I wanted to ask you about the character of Pauline and how Eugénie's desire for her to become a pupil is established prior to your romantic relationship. I mean, obviously the romantic relationship existed prior, but as far as like the information we're receiving, we kind of receive information about your desire to teach Pauline, the young girl first. How was that helpful for you as a performer and a mother to kind of start your narrative journey with Pauline before establishing that Dodin is your lover?
Yeah, it was written like this in the script, and I think probably because in the story my character doesn't have children, and it's and when you recognize somebody who's good at something that it's difficult, and probably because unconsciously or consciously she knows she will go one day because she's sick, there's a need of linking some kind of future into, not only because of what she knows, you know, as a cook, but also to give Dodin a sort of a path without her through this apprentice. So it was, you know, altogether a need of recognizing somebody very early on, because at the time, apprentices were very, you know, came into the game of work very earlier than today. And so as we learn, you know, in the film, to become a good cook takes, you know, half of your life, takes a long time to really have knowledge, for this. So, but what was moving to me in this film particularly is that doing this film with Benoit, who I had a relationship a long time before, and we had a daughter, it was related to our daughter in a way. And for me, this film became, through Hung's words, because he wrote the script, a sort of a bridge to declare my love, you know, to Benoit, because we hadn't spoken for a long time. We could have had a better relationship in the past. It didn't happen. That's the way it is. But then this film became a beautiful tool in order to make peace. And so for our daughter to watch the film was a very meaningful piece of art. if I may say. And so to go back to your question, you know, about this Pauline character, for me, it became my daughter in a way, you know, and in the real world, she was my daughter.
Thank you so much for saying that. I was wondering if could ask how that was brought into your previous relationship.
Yeah, I decided to talk, you know, privately, because I think it helps also, maybe it could help some people to use any kind of art form to express to another person their feelings. So you don't have to use your direct words and trying to have a meeting and saying, you know, I want to tell you this or I want to tell you that, which is can be very difficult or heavy or seems impossible. An art form is a wonderful tool in order to say to somebody without being too direct, you know, I care for you. You're in my heart, or I want to transform the relationship, or, you know, something about expressing a feeling. And I think in that case, this film was extraordinary for us, you know, as a tool. And who knew it, but didn't know it totally as well. I mean, you knew it, but you know, it can be done with making a cake or writing a poem or, you know, playing music or sending something special that you've handcraft, you know, something you made yourself, because it has some a stronger potential.
Oh, thank you so much. And since we are talking Pauline and apprenticeships, who do you feel like you each were maybe like the apprentice of, or like learned the most from in your craft when you were starting?
Oh, I think that I really liked Ozu, Mizoguchi, Kurosawa, Bresson, Robert Bresson, and also someone like Stanley Kubrick for its simplicity, you know. And because for me, Kubrick can. He has this way to simplify things, and by simplifying things, he reached a certain degree of deepness. You know, it's deeper when he simplify everything, and that was something that is quite amazing for me.
What really influenced me, I think I was 14, and my mother took me to the theater all the time because we loved it, and we went to see Peter Brook play Uburois, King Ubu, of Alfred Jarry, a French writer. And at the end of the play, I had so much joy. And I was in awe of how much a play could bring you, you know, inside of yourself. At the end of the play, everybody was, you know, standing up and applauding. And I thought, if I can give as much joy as what I received tonight, I want to do it.
Mm. That's lovely.
Yes, it's beautiful. Yes.
Oh, like Juliet, we get so much joy from art. Oh. Oh, can we all get a sigh for art?
Art.
So now, after that delicious international feature feast, welcome, welcome to Winner Winner Chicken Run Digestif. Changing it up there, because this show is thematic, of course. Oh, so we will each highlight a film that won an award somewhere, anywhere, as our chaser to this packed episode. I can kick us off. It has been pouring down and flash flooding in Los Angeles, and I braved it all to see a film that also takes place during a rare LA storm. Love streams on 35mm at the Egyptian Theater on the 35th anniversary of my ghost husband John Cassavetes' untimely passing.
Your timing is impeccable. It really is.
It really is. So this wonderful film came out in 1984. It was Cassavetes' final independently produced film before his death in 1989, And oh God, it plays like a swan song. John was dying and he knew it, and he shot this picture in his own house with his wonderful wife, Jenna Rollins. But they're playing siblings in this film. John is an alcoholic playboy novelist, and Jenna co-stars as his mentally ill sister who cannot stop adopting animals in a fruitless attempt to cure her brother's loneliness. It's a little bit wacky, which is unusual for John. Like, there is a full-on dream ballet in this thing. I'd seen it before, had completely forgotten about it because those are so not his very naturalistic style. So I was very surprised and baffled and delighted all at once. This qualifies for Chicken Run Dinner because John Cassavetes won the Golden Bear, the highest honor at the 34th Berlinale. And John and Jenna both won the Silver Ribbon for Best Foreign Actor and Actress from the Italian National Syndicate of Film Journalists. Okay, I need to join that coalition somehow. Not sure how yet. So long story short, they are a beautiful power couple and I'm very happy for them. Despite being married to the ghost of John Cassavetes, we are all in a relationship together somehow. Anyway.
the marriage laws are different in the afterlife.
Yes. Once you cross that realm. Okay. Last thing I'll say about this movie is that there are just so many great lines packed into it, such as, "I'm almost not crazy now," and "I love you, you Dumbo head." But the most iconic of all is, "Love is a stream. It's continuous. It doesn't stop."
Just like your marriage to the ghost John Cassavetes.
Exactly. It does not stop. So this movie, I really, really highly recommend it. But the thing is that it was pretty much unavailable to watch until 2014 when Criterion released it on DVD and Blu-ray. And it's still very difficult to watch. It is not streaming on any platform, which explains why it is so underseen with only 25,000 Letterboxd logs. It seems love doesn't stream after all. It is not continuous. It does stop. Okay.
Love streams is not streaming. And perhaps there's something we could all do about that. If you're listening and you own a streaming platform, get on it for the ghost of John Cassavetes. We need it.
We need it. We need
Brian,
it.
Brian, what's in your chicken run this week?
Well, Mia brought up a Cassavetes movie. And if anyone brings up Cassavetes in a four favorite video, she squeals. So I actually watched probably what is the most red carpeted four fave movie, The Godfather. I have not seen it in more than 25 years. Oh. I'm going to bring it back to some food stuff, you know, leave the gun, take the cannoli. There's a meatball recipe cooking session, which I definitely did not remember. There's obviously horse meat.
In a major way.
That's not.
I mean, people should still do contract negotiations that way in Hollywood, right? I mean, come on. Either that or just.
I could fix it.
That could fix it. Vegan alert.
What can I say about The Godfather that has not been said? It is a great film. It won multiple Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Actor. And Francis Ford Coppola won, but it was for screenplay. He did not win Best Director. But what struck me on my rewatch is kind of the scenes that I loved the most are the ones where the mafia, because, you know, it is a mafia movie for those who are not aware. But the best scenes are with how the mafia interacts with the public, with civilians, and bringing it back to food. My favorite scene involves Enzo the baker. Outside when Al Pacino, everyone thinks of like the scene that I said before, leave the gun, take the cannoli, as like when Al Pacino's Michael is leaning in and becoming a gangster like his family, because he has to protect his father. And even though his father doesn't want him to do that, but it happens earlier with Enzo the baker standing on the steps because he's aware that other rival gangsters are coming to assassinate his father, and he teaches Enzo the baker how to basically look tough. He puts up his collar and his hand in his pocket. And then afterward, when the mobsters run away, Enzo can't light a cigarette because his hands are shaking so much, but Michael is calm as can be. So that is the turning point long before the cannoli scene. Anyway, that stood out to me on this one.
What a moment of character. I love that so much. Spinger characters. Have you ever heard the story about Jerry Levitin, who went on to become a background actor in various weird and random films? But at the age of 14 in 1969, living in Toronto, he heard a rumour that John Lennon had flown in to into Toronto. So he ran around and tracked him down and snuck into his hotel room at the age of 14 and interviewed John Lennon for 30 minutes in 1969. Now that is journalism.
That works?
Well, it did in 69. I don't know if it still works now, but, you know, we'll get to that. This story I found out about because I was digging into the Oscar-nominated shorts ahead of next week. We'll have some short filmmakers on the show. And this is I Met the Walrus is what I watched. It's on YouTube. It's 5 minutes long. You can find it really easily. It qualifies because it won a 2009 Daytime Emmy. It won Best Animated Short from the American Film Institute and, of course, was Oscar-nominated. And so the film, the five-minute film, is essentially the 30-minute conversation with John Lennon, taped by Jerry Levitin, made into an animated short by director Josh Raskin, with illustration, beautiful pen illustration by James Braithwaite that harkens back to Yellow Submarine and includes some real found footage of a tape player and John Lennon and sort of things moving around him and literal animation and also figurative imaginative animation. Essentially, it's Lennon in 69 vibing about peace and activism. And his words, cheesy as they are as fresh today as they ever were. He says, kiss for peace, piss for peace. Whatever you do, just do it. Just do it for peace. It's an oddity for sure.
Use the voice.
I mean, my husband was born in Liverpool, so I feel like I'm allowed by
yes,
association. Yeah, speaking of international, you know, international films, I'm allowed a little Liverpool accent just for a minute. Speaking of, there's another Lennon at the Oscars this year, Sean, John's younger son. He's part of the team for War Is Over. We're going to hear from him next week about yet another Oscar-nominated short involving the words and music of John Lennon. And so that just leaves me to introduce the final course, Le Plateau à Fromage, the cheese board. And that is, I want to ask you both a question. Mia, Brian, take yourselves back to when you were 14 and tell me, who would you sneak into a hotel room to interview?
Robert Pattinson, and I would do it today because I think he would be down. Like, I actually think that wouldn't faze him too badly because he's a fellow weirdo and he would hear me out, whereas most others would not.
Especially if you were like, hi, Robert, I'm Mia Levitino, the future host of Best in Show at Letterboxd, which doesn't exist yet. Can I interview you for that?
Oh my God.
And they won't hear this for another, you know, decade plus.
Brian, come on.
I would have snuck into a hotel room to interview Muggsy Bogues, who was a very short basketball player. And I was a very short basketball player when I was 14. And they're on the same team, I would have then talked to the very tall man, Larry Johnson, who was a power forward for the Charlotte Hornets, but also he's famous for being grandmama for the Reebok shoes.
Amazing.
There once was a little old lady who lived in a shoe. That was the sketch. So I started to think of film people, but I was at 14, I was way more obsessed with basketball than I was film.
I'm bringing it back to John Cassavetes as our ender because he was also a short basketball player. Okay, there we go.
short kings forever. I am searching right now. Is there a short kings list on Letterboxd? There's got to be. Don't disappoint
there
me.
There has to be. Come on. Oh, I found a short kings list by Hannah. My favorite movies featuring my favorite short kings. First on the list, Mikey and Nikki. That's right. That's right.
You know that's right. There's also, bring it all back to international languages, Short Kings, Uber Alice, a list by Ricardo MC, 30 personal faves from leading men, 5'7"-ish and under. We have Humphrey Bogart. We have Takashi. We have Gene Kelly. We have
Gene Kelly.
James. Yeah, we have James Dean. We have Toshiro. We have Al Pacino.
Oh,
Al Pacino for our Gal Pacino.
How could we forget one of the iconic Short Kings? I'm going to comment on this list and say, please add Mikey and Nikki.
Though we should mention, I mean, Peter Falk is shorter than John Cassavetes. So he's the...
Wait.
Yeah, 5'6 versus 5'7.
You're blowing my mind. Short King joint slay. Thank you so much for listening to Best in Show. We would love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word as we get closer to the BAFTAs, the Indie Spirit Awards, and the Oscars.
Follow us and our Awards HQ on Letterboxd using the link in our episode notes, and we might comment on your Short Kings list. Drop us mailbag questions to podcast@letterboxd.com. If you have questions about the producer-director relationship specifically, we'd love to hear them. Thanks to our crew. Tall King Slim for the edit, Sophie for production, Trent Walton for the music, Tall King George Fennick for newslettering, Danny Haas for the art, the entire Letterboxd content team for all the extra good stuff, and extra Tall King Brian for overall producing genius.
And Muggsy Bogues, if you're a listener, I'm sorry, you are 5'3", not 5'1". Let's give you those 2 inches back. Thank you for listening. Best in Show is a Tape Deck production.
Cuckoo ka-choo.
Au revoir.
This is a Tape Deck podcast.